Hey guys, it's Lavetta.
And it's Miriam.
And this is the Notorious Women Podcast, a comedy podcast about some of history's most notorious women.
Yes, yes.
Whoa. We've had all the right. Fourth. So by the time this airs, we are into July. And I haven't melted yet into a chocolate puddle because it is hot, hot, hot.
Listen, this summer is no joke. It's no joke.
Global warming, man. Like, it is real. It is real.
I was going to make a joke about, do you think it's real? But it's not even funny. It's
no,
really
it's
bad.
Not even funny.
No.
It's just hot. I think that's why people are in a... You know, they do say that the heat affects people's mood. That's why, like, crime increases, but petty crime, like fights, that kind of thing increases during the summer months.
That actually, that's true. I'm doing an experiment and watching my children in my house. Fights are increasing. Yes.
Yeah.
That is facts.
Because they're hot.
We go to the pool all the time because I can't, because somehow when you throw water on children, it makes it like a little bit better. And it might just be better because you're also in water. And so if you go under the water, you can't hear them. You know
what I'm saying? I don't want to hear my kids. I also think there's a reason why the pool looks blue. Is it because it's calming?
Because
I like a saltwater pool myself. I prefer a saltwater pool. I don't know.
Okay, bougie. Okay.
No, it's just easier on the eyes and the hair and the skin. It doesn't dry you out. And it's very, anyway, I like a saltwater pool, but usually saltwater pools don't have that blue kind of tint. I don't know if that, is that the chlorine or is it just, do they paint the bottom of the pool blue? Is that what it is?
I think they paint the bottom of the pool blue. I think that's what it is. Because water is clear. But I think you knew that. I think the ocean looks blue, and so they paint the bottom of the pool blue, like lakes and rivers and things.
Whereas
are blue,
lot of saltwater pools, the bottom is not blue, or doesn't look
like
blue. It just looks like it's either white or kind of gray. So, but check out a saltwater pool. I did learn about a saltwater pool from bougie friends. I will say,
yes, but, I know.
So. Well, on that note,
I don't have access to a saltwater pool. Okay.
I do not have it. You have access to a pool in general now. I do not. That was a special thing. So I think we should get started because I think you said you may have, yours might be a little long. Mine is a little short and I am first this week.
Okay, does.
So my Notorious Woman this week is an homage to our nation's birth, the United States of America.
Okay.
You know, around kick the red coats out. The red coats are coming. The red coats are coming. To our British listeners, what's up? What's up?
Hey, hey, we want to be you.
We want that accent still. I rewatched one of my favorite I've been rewatching latest season of Bridgerton, which is, at first I was like, I don't know about this, but they stick the landing in the second part. So they stick
Okay,
of the season.
I actually haven't started the second part.
Yeah.
It's just been a busy week. That's honestly the only reason why. But listen,
but
I'm British. Like, can we be British without the colonialism? That sounds good to me.
No, we love the Brits, so
we do.
We're just joking. But this is an homage, my Notorious Woman this week, to, again, like I said, the founding of America, which was a British, well, it was many colonies, but primarily a British colony. So we fought the War of Independence and so on and so off. The Wikipedia, it's very, get the cliff notes, it's very, very simple. But 1776 is the year, and that's why we celebrate July 4th, which we've just celebrated by the time this comes out.
Yep.
So again, this is an homage to our nation's founding. And so my Notorious Woman this week is Abigail Adams.
I love her.
Yeah. We've already done the first lady. So it's only fitting that we do the second first lady, which is Abigail Adams.
She is one of my favorites. I think we'll find out if she remains one of my favorites.
Yeah, we'll find out. She is really a remarkable woman for her time in a lot of ways. So let's get into it.
So, okay, girl.
Abigail Adams was born Abigail Smith on November 11th, 1744, in the Julian calendar, which was a calendar that we used to follow before the current calendar.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, apparently there's a different calendar back then. So in today's calendar, it would be November 22nd, but the year is the same, 1744. In Weymouth, Massachusetts, to Reverend William Smith, a prominent and somewhat progressive minister, and Elizabeth Smith, a descendant of the Quincy family, and whose father, Abigail's grandfather, was the Speaker of the Massachusetts Assembly for about 40 years.
Oh, wow.
So
okay.
Abigail basically comes from a very prominent upper crust family, well-regarded family. And which is, it's again, during this time, it's just so odd that even though she's from a well-off, well-to-do family, she, like a lot of young women during her time, was not formally educated, which is just so odd to me. Right?
Yeah. Like, what else are they doing as children?
Well, basically, they were considered just baby-making machines, even at that level, even at that that echelon of society. They were just considered baby-making machines, period. Wombs, basically, which is what they're trying to take us back to today.
Hey, sure.
So, yeah. Now, again, she was not given formal education, but she availed herself of the family's library to master subjects most women would never even consider. And again, her father was progressive. He was very progressive in that sense that he was like, well, why shouldn't a girl learn how to read above a fifth grade level? You're like, oh, why shouldn't she learn how to read and learn about geography and philosophy and all those things? So he encouraged this this in her, which is, you know, encouraged her to read and learn as much as she could. And so that was that made him very progressive in that way versus being like, no, a girl shouldn't read. Her brain will hurt, you know. So by the time she was a teen, she was not only well read and intelligent, but she was also had a very strong sense of civic duty. So her family basically was one of those prominent families who also tried to do good in society. They weren't just prominent because they had money. They were prominent because they actually tried to do good in society and to help the poor. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they had a strong sense of civic duty, which is what why you should go. You should run for office because you want to help people and society, not to get money and take away people's rights.
There you go. That shouldn't be so hard.
It is. Oh, well. Now, despite like she's been known as a very progressive woman herself during this time. But again, slavery was everywhere. It's built into the fabric of America. There's no getting around it, despite what they're trying to take out of the history books. So her family also, even though they're in Massachusetts, but again, it's 1740s, 1750s. This is before the Revolution. They were also slave owners, and they had four souls who were enslaved on their property. Phoebe, Tom, Cato, and Tower were reportedly held in bondage by the family. Now, she would support, as well as her family, anti-slavery laws in Massachusetts, because obviously all of the colonies had slavery, and then it usually started in the North where they would pass these anti-slavery abolitionist laws and outlaw slavery. So she would fully support that. But she never expressed, you know, regret at being raised with slaves in her home. But on the subject of slavery, she saw firsthand what the fight for freedom from the British were like for the colonists. So she wrote to her later husband, John, in 1774, in the thick of it, quote, "I wish most sincerely that there was not a slave in the province. It always seemed to me to fight for ourselves for what we are robbing the Negroes of, who have as good a right to freedom as we have." So it's always seemed odd to me, is what she was saying, end quote. So it doesn't, being a good person doesn't mean you don't have any faults or you haven't done something in the past or engaged in stuff that And later on, upon later reflection, you're like, oh, maybe that wasn't the best.
Right.
But again, slavery was the norm. So it you would be hard pressed to find any white person in this country who's not the descendant of family who goes back this far, who did not own slaves. That's just the way it is.
Yeah.
No one's saying you are a terrible person. No one's even saying, oh, these people were terrible, you know, awful people mistreating people. One would hope that if you were going to be in bondage to people, that they were at least decent enough people to treat you like a human being and not like chattel, not like an animal.
Right.
So who's to say? But again, I just want to put that into context that it was the 1740s, 1750s. Slavery was everywhere in the colonies. And this is before it became the United States. And it also touched her family, even though later on they were strong abolitionists. Now, it is separate than John Adams' family, who were from the beginning, like, no, abolitionists, period.
Yeah. That's
So it's a different kind of situation. So I just wanted to.
I think that's an interesting note to point out, Livetta. I'm glad because I said I love her, and then I thought, do I? We're about to learn, right?
Right.
But I always thought of John and Abigail Adams as being anti-slavery, very vocally anti-slavery,
and they were.
It is interesting to note that she had to go on a little bit of a journey to recognize it because of where she came from. That's interesting.
And it is reported that after slavery was outlawed and Phoebe, who was an enslaved person under her family's watch when she was growing up, she kept in touch with Phoebe after Phoebe was freed. So again, it's one of those things where it's not, people say it's complicated. It's not really complicated. It's just the way it was, but it doesn't mean you have to be a terrible human being all the way around. So
well,
I think that.
I'm always here for people who learn and grow and do better. They didn't like at the last minute also like sell them to make money off of them. Do you know what I'm saying?
When I was 15, I was anti-abortion. I was.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, and I remember very vividly, my teacher broached the subject and I was like, well, obviously abortion's wrong. Right. Obviously.
Because you're a teenager.
I know nothing about life. And then when I start to live, like if you had asked me 4 years later while I was in college, I've been like, I cannot believe I said that. Like, and I was just so sure of myself at 15.
I find that really interesting. I feel like, you know, that's why like I'm here for people to grow. I think people don't like the subject of abortion. They don't understand truly what it is. There are so, right? There, if you live a very like
sheltered life, and honestly, that was not my opinion. That was the opinion of the adults around me who were like, a child is always a blessing no matter what, and da da da. And then when you get a little bit older and you see that the adults might think the child's a blessing, but the child that's born to parents who are poor, parents who don't want them, parents who are overwhelmed, who can't afford them, may not think it's a blessing. So, you know, but I always bring that up because I remember vividly having that thought. And then like, literally, like when once I was in college, I was like, I can't believe I ever said that out loud. But it wasn't my opinion. It was the opinion of the adults around me. So people do change. So now Abigail at age 15, So around 11, she got a tutor. She actually got, her father was like, okay, she's very intelligent, so we want to encourage this in her. Again, this is very unusual. So she got a tutor, a bit of a mentor, a man by the name of Richard, it's either Critch or Crinch. And he came into the family's home and he basically had a little crush on Abigail's sister, Mary. So he was trying to get in them draws. Richard's like, listen here. I'm trying to see what I can see. I'm trying to holler at homegirl. So he's very nice to Abigail, the little sister, and he wanted to prove himself an honorable man and, you know, a good catch to catch Mary's eye. And a friend of Richard was John Adams, who was a law student. And John, now, apparently John and Abigail, when they first met, because she was a kid, they weren't impressed with each other. He was just like, oh, okay, there's a little kid. And she was like, well, you're not that handsome. So they were not like oil and water. It's just like, whatever.
How old was John?
It doesn't say I didn't really pay attention to John, but he was older than her. So he was Richard's age. So he was not 11. Okay. So he... And also, he's probably looking at her like, even though I know girls got married at like really young back then, but he was just like, oh, as a kid, and then she's opinionated. It's like an annoying little kid.
Yeah.
And she was like, yeah, you're not handsome either. So, okay, feelings mutual. But they did get to know each other more. So they were well acquainted with each other. Okay. And he with her family. And then something clicked when she came of age. You know, like around, it's probably when she came out to society, 17, 18. Yeah. And all of a sudden he just saw her in like a new light. And he was like, basically heart eyes. And he was just like, oh, like, okay.
She was a child and now she's not, you know.
Which that says a lot about him, that he was just like, oh, a little annoying kid and not like lusting after a 11-year-old. So, which is
that good. Is good. I think this is a good story.
It's a good sign. Yeah. And so once he just was like, oh, she's a woman now. I mean, like, so he started pursuing her. And by society's account, they had a long engagement, but just about 18 months. Two married in, she was at age 20. The two married in 1764. So Abigail Smith married John Adams. By this time he was a Harvard graduate and he was beginning his professional law career.
Okay.
The couple moved to John's farm in Braintree, south of Boston. And eventually they had three sons and two daughters. As his career was going, you know, and improving and, you know, heating up, he began to travel more. And then we can't forget, they are in the context of the revolution.
Yeah.
So they are colonists. They're British colonists all this time. And then there's this descent. The Brits, do you know the redcoats could literally just come into your house and sleep in your bed?
Yes, I remember.
They could just
that.
Literally do that. Like, yeah. just pissed.
We and have so, specific laws because of that.
Because of that.
Yeah.
And so they're coming of age and getting married and starting a family in all of this unrest, all of this stuff that's going on. So he started traveling because you have to pick sides. You're a loyalist to the British crown.
Right.
Or you're a patriot.
Yep.
Which they misuse today, but that's what
they
that means.
They sure fucking do, but yes.
So he began to travel around, and she, for her part, she basically was at home at their farm, and she started to run the property, which was an unusual thing, but on her own, and she had to learn, and thank God she was intelligent. Yeah. That's why you got to marry well, because when you're not away, you don't want an idiot at your house, don't know what they're doing. So
yeah, because they live there.
They live there
the whole time. Yeah.
And while she liked having the independence and being able to run a home and make decisions, you know, the actual decisions about the property and the running of the property, she missed her husband. She got married for a reason. But she also made investment decisions that enhanced the family's money. So basically, she became a boss bitch. And he married wisely. So, but she became very lonely, and they would be apart for a lot of the earlier part of their relationship. And even after the children started coming, because again, they're in the midst of this political strife that's going on. Yeah. And then we go straight into, once we get in the war, it's on. And because of her, she had a way with the pen. She was very well read, and she could express herself. I love back then they were so flowery with their language, and but she would often send him updates on like the activities of the redcoats, and you know, just keep him abreast of things that were going on. Now, early on in his career, he actually defended. I believe he defended someone like a British officer, much to the disagreement of the local populace in Boston. But he felt like everyone had the right to a fair trial, which would become the bedrock of American legal system, where it's supposed
to
be. Right.
Right.
So this made them unpopular for a for a while, a short period of time. And she would always publicly support her husband, even though she would criticize him too. She's very opinionated, especially for a woman at that time.
But I like her so much. Okay.
But I love it because she knew that she was a bad bitch. She knew she was smart and she knew she was capable, which she learned early on. You know, so by the time she was 11 and he met her, she was very confident in at least her intellect and in her beliefs and her thoughts. So that carried into her marriage. And so, but she was a supportive wife. So she knew, she understood, like, publicly, I have to support my husband and that kind of thing. But again, he traveled a lot, which, you know, is very, very difficult. But she understood, especially once they got into the actual revolution.
I mean, I cannot even imagine. You have 5 kids. No.
Exactly.
And he's traveling and who knows where he is. And he can't text you.
Can't
text
you.
You do not know what's going on. There are
no
pictures
to get a letter.
Yep. Weeks to get a letter.
Weeks to get a letter. And, you know, obviously she loved him. That's why she married him. And they had known each other. So they were friends before they got married, obviously.
Right.
It wasn't one of those things where she met him and 6 months later they were engaged to be married or married at 6 months later. So. Because again, this is the time of, this is the Edwardian, we call it colonial time here, but in England, it's the time of Queen Charlotte is on with King George is on the throne. So all the Bridgerton shenanigans are happening at this time. So.
Now I know exactly what's happening in Britain. I've seen the show.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So she also historically, she has provided some of the most in-depth and specific accounts of what was happening in the colonies in Massachusetts at this, in Boston at this time, Boston Tea Party, all that other stuff. And so her letters are in Historical Society, obviously the Presidential Historical Papers, because she was so well read and her letters are very, very historically important to America.
Yeah.
So now in March of 1776, we go through the revolution, thank God we win. And now it's like about what's the legal stuff? Like, how do we plot this out? How do we distinguish ourselves from the English? Like, we don't want a monarchy. How do we do all of this?
Right.
So they're drafting everything up. So in March of 1776, John Adams is participating in the First Continental Congress in Philadelphia.
Yes.
And while they're getting ready, to write up the Constitution. You know, all men are created and all that other stuff, right? Except for black people. My favorite founding father is Benjamin Franklin. I know he looked like a turkey and he wanted our national bird to be a turkey.
Wow.
But Ben Franklin is my boy. He was not a perfect man, but he was my boy because he's the one who came up with the idea of libraries, post office, all kinds of inventions.
Fire
my favorite
fighting.
Founding father.
Yeah.
Yeah. My that's my guy. So they're all these influential, some wealthy white men are
bustle.
Because they all sound like British people.
Yes, it's
right?
Still British from the
so they're writing. So Thomas Jefferson's coming back from France, impregnating Sally, doing all kinds of things, looking like a fancy man, and
what
being a terrible
I
person.
Miss?
What did I miss? So, you know, they're all there like trying to figure this out. They're actually doing actual work, right? And so Abigail famously wrote in one of her most famous letters and one of the most famous letters in American history. She wrote to remind her husband, John Adams, to remember the ladies. She wrote famously, quote, quote, if particular attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have not voice nor representation. End quote. She goes on to say, quote, do not put such unlimited power into the hands of the husbands. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. End quote.
Yes, now, Abigail, she is correct.
She is correct. Now, a lot of people will point to that saying, oh, she was a feminist, da da da. It was, there was no sort of, she couldn't even conceive of that. She wasn't necessarily talking about giving women the right to vote. What she was saying, she wanted him to codify marriage protections for women.
Yeah.
Because at this time, basically, when a husband married his wife, he took everything from her. He owned her. He owned her like she was a slave, like seriously, legally. So he owned her body. He owned all her property. He owned everything. He even owned her children. He could take her children.
Yeah.
Yep. So that's what she wanted him to suggest to put into the Constitution to protect women from that. She wasn't even thinking about the vote, like, but because it's like that's one of the reasons that women later fought for the vote for these kinds of protections. Like,
I don't,
so we can
I don't
have
think
our own
women,
thing.
I don't think women in general realize how second class of a citizen we were.
Yeah. And this is a well off white woman.
Yes. Like there's no one who has more privilege than Abigail Adams. Yep. She is the most in the privileged class with the, she is as a woman, she is owned and she has no say on her body or her children or her life as a general. Like it's, I mean, it was the 1990s when domestic rape became illegal.
Yep.
Y'all, we got things to fight for.
Yep. And we got things to keep hold of and like not slide back to these things. But that's what she was calling for, because at this time, that's why her father had to approve of her wanting to read and get educated.
Yeah.
Her
yeah.
father had to approve of that. If her father was a different kind of man, she would have turned out to be a completely different kind of woman.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, it never would cross her mind about the right to vote. But she did, again, wanted women to retain ownership of whatever they brought into the marriage. So they would have, because she realized even then that financial independence meant that a woman could have some say so. She would have recourse for over mistreatment.
Right.
And again, literally during this time, when a woman married a man, she was treated as his property once they were married.
Yeah. Yep.
So her dowry, any property she had, and like I said, even her body was given over to her husband to do with whatever he saw fit to do with it.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's be clear about that. Now, because women, women should always choose the bear. We've established, and this is why. Okay, always
every
choose
time.
The bear. Because the bear's not trying, the bear's like, you got any food? You're trying to mess with my young? All right, bet. I'm going to be on my way. Not means. But she also saw firsthand like brutal husbands who were not John. Like, they would just literally treat their wives worse than their livestock.
Oh, yeah.
So, again, not quite the feminist that we think of today. She, along with Judith Sargent Murray, set out to expand women's education, at least, because she understood at that time, again, being educated, being able to not only read, but comprehend, to be able to advocate for yourself always. And she also understood the importance of mothers. So if you have if you marry a dumb, uneducated woman, then how is she going to look over
her children,
the education of your children, including your sons, right?
No,
so
it's true.
She and Judith believed that a mother had a vital role in preparing sons, even because that's who was valued then, to be virtuous citizens and leaders in the new republic that was to be America.
Mm-hmm.
So so she said this to John. John was like, all right, woman, whatever. He didn't really take her seriously. Reportedly even laughed at her to suggest that he should suggest such a thing to a room full of men. But it didn't mean that he didn't think that she had a wonderful mind. And he often did take her advice, even if he didn't in that instance.
Okay.
He often sought her opinions on political matters as well as other matters within their lives. Also, because he probably came back home and was like, oh, she actually is running this place really, really well. Like, thank God.
And we have more money. Wow.
Yeah.
That's not because of me. Huh.
But John proved not to be the best husband. And I don't know if it was just him wanting to be away from her or being ambitious, but it's also, it could have been the time period. A lot was going on. So again, he was away for long stretches of time during, especially the early part of their marriage. After, you know, again, the British were defeated, he he was appointed as diplomat. So he went away Yeah. Reportedly for 5 years, between 1783 to 1788, yeah, traveling in Europe as a diplomat. Now, by her own account, by her letters, but also by other historians, she was very lonely because, again, she got married to be with someone and she obviously liked his company.
Yeah.
She liked talking to him. You know, she liked her husband. It sounds like she liked her husband when they were together. So she's very lonely and she's got these children. And I'm sure, like, you know, as much as she liked having the independence of taking care of the business of their home, it was, she was just lonely. She's still a young woman. So she still wants to, she was still wants to, don't know. So
wait, do you think he stayed faithful? I don't know
because I think during this time, I feel like fooling around was like accepted.
No, it was never accepted. It was understood, but I don't think it was accepted.
Understood, especially on the man's end, but also but reportedly, speaking of, that's what I was about to get to. Apparently, she was so lonely that she had an affair with a notorious womanizer, Lothario, who's a gigolo. I have a feeling that there were always these men around in society who were like, lonely rich lady. How can I help you?
you are so pretty.
Yeah. You need me to rub your back. And they called him the maintenance man. There was this like society of books. I feel like in the late 90s, early 2000s, and it was literally called the maintenance man.
That
like
is hilarious, it was like, and I love it.
They called it like, not city. What's the urban fiction? Like it meaning black. Oh, yeah. And it was literally a series. The guy was called the maintenance man. He would come in and maintain your woman because you couldn't. So, so yeah, she had an affair with this guy and then she ended it. But she now also during this time,
your husband thinks it's okay to take a job thousands of miles away for years on end. Yeah. She got herself a maintenance man. Okay.
And, yeah, exactly. And also, he didn't invite her, but he invited his sons, sons to come. So,
fuck him.
Including Quincy. So in 1784, she was like, fuck this. So she, along with one of her daughters, decided to go and be with her husband and her children. Because she was like, I'm tired of this shit. Like, the place is going to run itself now. So I'm coming to visit. So she went to join her husband and she stayed with him until he returned in 1788. Now,
yeah, he was fully. Wait, what year was it that she went to stay with him?
1784.
Oh, so just a year. Okay. Yeah, just a year. He was cheating on her.
But again, that was just when he became a diplomat. Before all of that, before the war, he was also absent a lot, traveling around. Mm-hmm. I think part of it is that he was also trying to drum up business, like as a lawyer, like try and get his career going. He wasn't as well connected as her. He was really trying to get a career. No, I agree. Because it's like, well, if you got to travel around and then, you know, you have to decide, are you going to take, there's a lot going on because they got married during this political strife, and then there was a war. But after, there's no excuse. He should have invited her. So she actually, he didn't invite her. She just went. She was like, I'm coming.
That's right. That's right. I'm here. Send your mistress home. Okay. Take all of her shit with her. Thank you, babe.
And especially he in Europe with the, you know, like, even if you guys have, it's about loneliness because sometimes it's just not about sex. It's about companionship, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So they go to Europe and they stay there until 1788. And then in 1789, George Washington became president and John Adams became his vice president.
Right.
So they come back, and now as the wife of the first vice president, she became a good friend to Martha Washington. But unlike Martha Washington, who was very she and reveled at being like a Karen.
Fancy pants?
She's the original
Fancy
Karen. Pants? Yeah. Abigail, even though, again, she comes from a prominent family, she was a lot more, she wasn't really into the fancy parties necessarily, but she understood that that's what was expected of her. So she also learned while they were abroad, she learned about the experience of the courts and the society. And because the Europeans were very much, because again, Bridgerton is going on at this time. So,
right.
She learned a lot because again, she's from like a more of a religiously leaning, not puritanical, but like much more reserved lineage from Massachusetts, yes, versus like in the South where they're like reveling the slaves and the work camp that is called the plantation and all this right. other stuff. So she learned, she realized she had to kind of put on appearances for this new nation. Cause you know, you want people to think that this new nation is also good. So, now, again, she made friends with Mrs. Washington. But around 1791, she had poor health. And so she had to spend a lot. She had to go back home to spend more time at home to recover. Side note, during the war, they always had like smallpox outbreaks, yellow fever outbreaks, whole bunch of stuff that was going on. Like, and she's doing all this on her own as a young wife and mother. So around 1791, she became ill. So she went back home to recover.
Okay.
And thank God she did. She recovered. Yeah. And she once said, quote, not forget the blessings which sweeten life. So she was like, maybe I need to live a little bit more and not just be so bogged down. I'm sure it's because her children are getting a little bit older. So
yeah.
Mama need to be happy too. Okay. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Now, again, she often was very supportive of John, but she also would criticize him. You know, she would defend him. So in 1798, there was a controversial Alien and Sedition Act.
And that was a fun one.
Yeah, that was a fun one. So she would support him, I guess, again, politically in publicly, but in private, she would give her honest opinions to help him navigate this. But she was a very supportive wife. Now, in 1797, John Adams became president after Washington. So he's the second president of the United States of America, and she became the second first lady.
Yes.
They also became the first family to actually occupy the White House because George and Martha, remember, that was when they weren't sure where the Capitol was going to be. It was in Philadelphia.
Oh, right.
And so during this time, they had moved made the Capitol Washington, D.C.
I know because I watched Hamilton. Okay.
Because you watched Hamilton. So, mm-hmm. and construction on the White House was still underway, actually. They became the first family to occupy the actual White House in 1797. And again, she was always an outspoken lady. So she was an outspoken first lady, very different than Martha Washington, who loved giving balls and, you know, and so she was a lot. I feel like Abigail Adams is much more, we would call her a practical woman, and she'd be much more of closer to a modern woman than I think Martha. Martha Washington would be like a Gwyneth Paltrow.
I feel
type.
Like Martha was like, I've seen queens do this.
Yeah.
I can be similar.
Yeah.
And Abigail was like, I'm born and raised in Massachusetts.
I'm an American.
We don't like slavery.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah.
And honestly, you need a lot of slaves to do all of these balls.
Yeah.
You need a lot of slave labor.
You do. Yeah.
So that wasn't really her thing, but she did keep up appearances. She did do, you know, the dinners and things like that, but it was much more subdued by contrast to the Washingtons.
I believe.
And again, just to drive home how much John, even though he laughed at her about her suggestion about protecting women in marriage, he always sought out his wife's attention because he realized, oh, she's actually smart. She gives really good advice.
Yeah.
So when he got the news that he was going to become president, he wrote to her, quote, I never wanted your advice and assistance more in my life. Thank God I have you, end quote. Well, not thank God
damn
I have
straight.
You, but end quote.
Damn straight.
Now, again, they moved to the White House, and it was still a lot of wilderness around it. They were still like building it. They were still trying to figure it out. And so she wrote privately. She talked about like, this was a dump. Like, what the hell is going on? Like, I mean, I'm from Massachusetts, but like, what the hell is going on here? But she, again, she still held the dinners and receptions. And again, publicly was like, oh, the White House, great. But behind the scenes, she was like, what is, oh my Lord, this is the ghetto.
Am I supposed to raise my children in this trash?
Yeah. Okay. But again, she was, she went along with it. So she, and this is why I like her, because she's just like, she made lemonade out of lemons. So she's like, we'll do the best of what we can.
Yeah.
Now, unfortunately, the next election, John Adams lost in 1801. So the couple retreated back to Massachusetts, where she maintained correspondences with political leaders, including President Thomas Jefferson, mm-hmm. who defeated John Adams.
Yes.
And James Madison, as well as Dolly Madison, as well as Martha Washington and all those other stuff. And famously, when I did Martha Washington, remember when George died and Martha, and basically George was like, I'll free the slaves when Martha dies. And so Abigail was like, girl, don't you. So it is in their best interest that you leave this earth soon. And so Martha was like, oh, yeah,
that's right.
We didn't think that through. So Martha freed her slaves while she was still living.
Right.
And Abigail's like, yeah, you should start paying them because maybe you'll live a lot longer. So, yeah, very practical, practical woman.
Right.
Now, she, again, and so once they went back to Massachusetts, that's when they actually got to spend a lot more time together. And by this time, the kids were of age. And she actually was not only the wife, the first lady of the second president of the United States, but she was the mother of the sixth president of the United States, John Quincy Adams. So who won his election as president in 1824. Now, in 1848, her grandson, Charles Francis Adams, would publish a lot of her papers. And so that's when the public became aware of like, oh, she was like actually very intelligent and like, well-read and like, yeah. So they stayed retired. They basically retired after that election in 1801 and for 17 years enjoyed companionship that, you know, public life had denied them and life together. She and which led up to Abigail's death in 1818 at the age of 73.
Too young.
And she actually was survived by her husband, who was older than her by 8 years. Wow. Eventually, the two were buried beside each other in the United First Parish Church.
Okay.
But that type of Abigail Adams, she was so unusual. So because during her life, not only was she an outspoken woman, she was an intelligent woman, but she also really helped shape the early country that became America in not only the way that she advised her husband in practical matters, slavery, because they were very anti-slavery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But she also would go on to raise, again, another president. She has the distinction of being only one of two women who've done that.
Who's the other one?
The other one being Bush.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Barbara Bush.
Yeah,
so that is Abigail Adams, and she is definitely on my list of favorite first ladies because she was a remarkable woman. And she was a woman who, again, her family did own four souls enslaved when she was a child growing up. But she learned from that. And even then, after she became an adult, which was still not that popular, she and her husband both were vehement abolitionist and from the beginning of the inception of the United States of America were anti-slavery. So
I think that like she's such a great example of learning and growing and doing better and being better. Like I think it's important to allow for that. And because when you allow for that, maybe that encourages other people to go, you don't have to double down on your crazy asshole president. You know what I'm saying? Sorry. But you know what I mean? Like you can learn, you can grow, you can say, you know what? I can do better. Yeah. I love that. I love her.
I love that. Yeah, because it's like she was a woman in the best sense of the word, that a woman has a right to change her mind. So
yeah,
Abigail Adams was amazing.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Okay. it's my turn.
Yes.
So let me tell you how I discovered this woman.
Okay.
My child, I have a child who really wants to be an architect. And so at school, they have this thing where they can go research things. I don't even know what it is. Like, I'm not the mom who knows everything in school. I just send them to the school and then I make sure they behave and like do decently and then, you know, take them to the park. Okay, that's me. So he was like, have you heard of Zaha Hadid? And I was like, what? And then my other child was like, yeah, Zaha Hadid. And I was like, huh? Because my children are already smarter than me. So he was looking for architects and discovered like this amazing female architect. I've never heard of her. She is renowned and incredible. And I was like, I need to do her podcast.
Yes.
Not that my children will ever listen to this podcast.
And she sounds Middle Eastern, which is even more awesome.
Yes.
I love that.
Oh my God. This she's fascinating. Okay. So Zaha Hadid, she was born on Halloween, October 31st, in 1950 in Baghdad, Iraq. She was born to an upper class Iraqi family. Now, her father is Muhammad Al-Haj Hussein Hadid. Mm-hmm. I'm going to try really hard to not butcher names. Okay. I think I did that last one pretty good.
I think you did that one. That sounds pretty good. But again, I'm not Arabic, or I don't speak Arabic, I could be all way off.
I know a little Hebrew, but it's not the same exactly. Yeah. So he was a wealthy industrialist from Mosul.
I think it's Mosul.
Yeah. And he co-founded the left liberal Al Ahali Group in 1932, which was a significant political organization in the 30s and the 40s. He was also the co-founder of the National Democratic Party in Iraq, and he served as Minister of Finance after the overthrow of the monarch after the 1958 Iraqi coup d'etat for the government of General Abd al-Karim Qasim. So she comes from people who make things move. Her mother was Wajiha al-Sabunji, and she was an artist from Mosul, and her brother Fulaf was a writer, an accountant, and an expert on Arab affairs. Okay, so this is where she comes from. In the 1960s, she went to boarding school in England, Switzerland. Now, she wanted to be a mathematician, but apparently at some point, she was like, I like shapes more than I like numbers. So she shifted concentration to architecture.
This girl is a brain. What child is like, I want to work with numbers?
You and I were like, I want to be a star.
Yeah, I'm like, I want to dance and wear pretty dresses and be a ballerina. She's like, I want to work with numbers.
I know.
What?
I don't understand. I'm so confused.
I love it. And I love it. It's a little girl saying it. I love it.
Yeah. Right? So she studied science at the American University of Beirut. This was a little wonky for me. I had like science or math. Like she wanted to be a mathematician, so she studied science. I don't know. But she ended up
You need math to study science. So
you do. You need it all.
That's what Star Trek told me. I'm just saying.
That was, you know, the brunt of your science education, honestly. I love you. but I know what you studied, okay?
Yes.
Same girl. Okay. So in 1972, she moved to London to study at the Architectural Association School of Architecture, which I love. I'm going to say it again. Ready? The Architectural Association School of Architecture.
They're like, architect.
Yeah, just say it three times and you'll be an architect. Mm-hmm. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
So she's wanting to be an architect and she is an amazing architect. I'm just going to give that away. Her first inspiration was when they would visit Sumerian cities like in southern Iraq. And those cities, I just learned, were like considered the first civilization. Like,
there.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Now I want to go.
Oh, yeah. I definitely want to go. If the war, there's always wars that stops you. So
yeah. If everyone could, my kids have some good ideas of stopping all of war all the time. Something along the lines of make it illegal and then pass it. And I was like, that's a really good idea. I agree.
Kids have the answers, but we don't listen to them. It's very simple.
Yeah. It's bad. We should not do it. And I was like,
yeah,
you're right. You're 100% right.
But you know what? We can't, because again, Earth is the ghetto. The aliens are like, nope, not stopping there. The
aliens ghetto. Are like, oh, don't go there. You guys, it's the worst. And you and I are like, take us. We're very nice.
No probing, please, though. No, I don't want to.
Yeah, absolutely not. Yeah. No.
Just beam me up.
just beam me up. Give us some good food. Okay.
Yeah.
We'll do some dance classes. All right. I like to dance. Anyways. I'll move on. All right. So she got to study with people. I'm going to give you their names and maybe you know who these people are. Rem Koolhaas, Elia Zingelis, and Bernard Tschumi. I've never heard of them, but apparently they're like, you know, architects that are like, you know, super good.
You're schooling me today. I haven't heard these names. So
I think our podcast makes us like basically aware of like so many things, but we are not the master of anything, you know.
Hashtag not historians. I'm just
hashtag not historians. Yeah. Okay. So she worked with them after she graduated. Because they loved her. So Koolhaas described her as a planet in her own orbit. Zingelis described her as the most outstanding pupil he had ever taught. So she works for them at the Office for Metropolitan Architecture in Rotterdam in the Netherlands.
Wow.
And then somehow became a naturalized citizen of the UK. I don't know the link, but I'm sure there is one.
Maybe because she went to school there. Maybe from that she went to grade school there. Maybe so.
It could be.
Yeah,
it could be. And she opened her own architectural firm, Zaha Hadid Architects, or Zha, Zha. But I like to think Zha, you know, with an exclamation point. You know,
give it a little pizzazz. I like it. Yeah,
a little jazz hands. Okay.
Yeah.
I mentioned I like to dance. All right. So this happened in 1980. Now, in 1980, her style, she is introducing her style, which is a little different than other modern architecture style. But she had very detailed and professional sketches. Now, because she was different, they were interested, but not that interested in actually doing her stuff. And she kind of famously was like, all of her sketches were really interesting, but then she would like draw stairs to nowhere or the joinery. I think it's called the joinery didn't make sense. And her theory was that I'm creating the big picture and the joinery will make sense when that big picture is created. And later this proved true.
Oh, wow.
So if you like love architecture and that's why you're listening to this podcast, I hope I made sense to you because that's why I said it. Thank you. So she started teaching. So she's teaching at the Architectural Association, then Harvard Grad School Design, Cambridge University, University of Chicago. I'm going to try to
say
this.
I'm sorry to interrupt. So
no worries.
So professional career, they didn't want to build her designs.
Right.
They wanted her to teach Harvard grad.
Yeah.
So she was good enough to teach, but not for them to invest to make her actual designs.
Isn't that interesting?
It sounds like feminism. And it sounds like lady parts are getting in the way.
Yeah, she did have boobs and a vagina.
Yeah,
so,
I don't, in a lady brain.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
Okay. So she earned her early reputation with her lecturing and she had her colorful and radical early designs. So they were starting to be published, but nobody was building them. So they're loving her. She's published now. Still no building.
Yeah.
Okay. So she's like, this is fucking shitty. I'm mad. But that's not how she phrased it. It's just what she thought. Now, one of the things that went unbuilt was her plan for peak in Hong Kong in 1983. Now, she had a plan for an opera house in Cardiff, Wales in 1994. It was chosen as the best by the competition jury, but the Millennium Commission, which was the funding body, refused to pay for it. And her quote in response to this was, "Do they want nothing but mediocrity?" The answer to that, I think, is yes.
That's a bar. Do they want nothing but mediocre? That is a bar. Right? As the kids say, that's a bar right there. Like, right. Wow. Yeah.
I say, do you throw down your gauntlet at me? Because Shakespeare. Yes. So, in 1988, so time is going. This is a little bit earlier. She was chosen to show her drawings and paintings as one of seven architects to chosen to participate in the exhibition Deconstructivism in Architecture at MoMA, Museum of Modern Art. I always forget. So her reputation is growing, and finally, she's getting hired. I cannot go through every single thing she is hired to do because there is so much, and that is awesome.
I love that. I love how the dam opened up for her and like, oh, yes. I love that.
And you guys, like, we'll just like harass the internet with all of these images. It's so cool. Like, it's so cool. Her stuff is amazing.
So now what time did she, what's the year that her stuff started getting?
So about 1993, Rolf Feilbaum, who is the president director of the Swiss furniture firm Vitra, he's a super fancy dude. He worked with Gary, and now he's working with her. And he wanted her to make a small fire station for his factory. Now, it was so cool, and it's really neat, but it's no longer used as a fire station.
Because it's too cool to be a fire station, probably.
This became an issue later. Now, I don't know if it was specifically this one, but I mean, it's a piece of art. Now, yes.
Yeah, but I love that. I love that.
And then in 1994, she was commissioned by the city of Vienna to design and construct a three-part scheme for the urban redevelopment of an area adjacent to the Danube. Thank you. And this was designed by her company, Zsa.
Okay. Zsa.
I want to talk about this. She designed a ski jump, which is so cool, in Innsbruck, Austria.
I guess you do have to design a ski jump. I would never even thought that was a thing. Oh, wow.
Right? Okay, I forgot to write down the year. It was like in the 90s. It was for one of the Olympics. Now, the old ski jump was built in 1926, but it had been used in 1964 and 1976, the Winter Olympics. But this ski jump had to also contain a cafe. It also had 150 seats offering a 360-degree view of the mountains. Y'all, it's a ski jump and a cafe. It's so cool.
Oh, wow. I want to go there.
Me too. Let's
go. Take a trip, Notorious Women.
Yes. I want to take a Notorious Women trip to go to all the places for all the women we talk about.
Oh, now you're speaking my language.
Yes.
That's right.
Right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So she, at the end of the 90s, so her career is gathering more and more momentum. She won commissions for two museums and a large industrial building. She competed against one of her old teachers, Rem Koolhaas, for the design of the Contemporary Art Center in Cincinnati, Ohio. Now, she won and became the first woman to design an art museum in the United States.
What year? Like
1997.
She became the first woman. Wow. Yes.
Didn't we solve feminism by that?
We saw feminism in the 70s when women got the right to open up their own bank account, right?
And then racism was solved in 1964, right? Civil rights. Yes. So this is all very confusing.
Yeah, it's all very, our lady brains are hurting, Miriam.
I know, right? Okay. So in 2000, she won an international competition for the Fano, I'm saying it wrong, Science Center in Wolfsburg, Germany. And this one looks like a ship. It is so cool.
Ooh. Looks that means she can build spaceships. See, that's what she's doing. She's building spaceships and she's saying they're like fire stations and like in museums, but they're really spaceships. Yeah. That's what they are.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So in 2002, now, okay, I'm going to talk about this because I think this might be my favorite. She won an international competition for her first project in China. It's the Guangzhou Opera House. Ooh. And it is so beautiful. It makes me cry a little. So beautiful. It's an 1,800 seat theater, a multi-purpose theater, entry hall, and a salon. Now,
wow.
Around this time, she was appointed commander of the Order of the British Empire.
Oh, she became a dame. Oh, a dame. Excuse me.
So she's like royalty now.
Oh, fancy.
And I think you have to bow to her when you talk about her.
So she's Lady Zha. No, I'm just kidding.
Lady Zha.
Lady Zha.
Yes. I'm making the musical right now. Okay.
Jazz hands. So, jazz hands.
Jazz hands. Just has all day. All right. So in 2004, she won the Pritzker Architecture Prize. This is the most prestigious prize in architecture. So she'd only completed four buildings. So I'm talking about stuff where some of it I know I talked about more than that she's still working on. But four had been done.
Oh, had been finished. Okay, completed. Okay.
But Thomas Pritzker, who this award is named after, says of her, quote, "Although her body of work is relatively small, she has achieved great acclaim and her energy and ideas show even greater promise for the future." P.S. First woman to win this prize. Okay.
Of course she is.
Of course she is.
It sounds like her mind is so like galactic. Like,
yes.
I'm sticking to the sci-fi theme because that's what I think it is. Like the fact that she's like, I'm going to build steps and then you just have to build the thing that the steps go to. I just love that.
Yeah. And you know, she probably has on her team the scientists, the people who can make it what it needs to be. So then like in between 97 and 2010, she started like entering into the engineer's domain of bridge construction.
Oh.
And did so in she constructed a couple of them, one of which the Sheikh Zayed Bridge, which honors Sheikh Zayed bin Sultan Al Nahyan. I think I said that close to right.
That sounds like a really, really rich and exalted man somewhere in the Middle East.
I loved like. Aladdin so much, and I watched it over and over and over again. I am only thinking of Papa. Okay. this bridge connected mainland Abu Dhabi and Abu Dhabi Island and the international airport of Abu Dhabi.
Oh, wow.
So cool. And it's so beautiful. In 2008, she was ranked 69th on the Forbes list of the world's 100 most powerful women. In 2010, she was named by Time as, an influential thinker in the 2010 Time 100 issue. In September 2010, the New Statesman listed her at number 42 in its annual survey of the world's 50 most influential figures of 2010. So,
wow.
Now, this bridge, P.S., was inaugurated November 25th, 2010, by late UAE President Sheikh Khalifa. The ceremony was also attended by Queen Elizabeth II, which marked her second state visit to the United Arab Emirates. Wow. So, yeah. Now, there's some criticism. We could talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Her work is really, really expensive. Like, really expensive.
Miriam, spaceships are expensive, okay?
That's true.
Because they can go to space.
I'm talking
to house whole, like, societies.
Right. And then you have to go where no one has gone before.
Before. Uh-huh. That makes me so happy.
I know, sweetheart.
I love it.
Like, I'm talking to Lovetta's inner child right now, and it's the cutest thing ever. Yeah.
I love it.
But remember in 2008 when the economy, like, went kaboom?
Oh, yeah. That? Well, so yeah, unfortunately, I do.
Yeah, I do too. It was not good
still
for
recovering.
Yep. I think so. I agree. Yeah. So then there's the argument of, like, is this wasteful? Mm-hmm. Is art, well, yeah, you know, like that art for art's sake versus art for, but what I read is that in China and the Middle East, they were not hit as hard. And they continued to commission her, and she continued to take their money and do her thing. So that, you know, that it's just, it's out there, you know.
Yeah,
I always take
the money, especially when they always take the money, as long as it's not illegal and you're not hurting somebody. But
right,
like if you're providing a job as an architect and they're willing to pay you, nations would take the money. Like,
I would,
a solve to this, though, is that these buildings and these structures are not just for the wealthy. They're for everybody. Remember that, how I said I loved, Benjamin Franklin? And one of the reasons I love him so much is because he created things that the majority of people could use.
Everyone could have access to,
yes,
like most people could have access.
Yeah. Yes. So I'm joking about spaceships and da da da, and they might look like that, but it's like if she's building a library or she's building a museum, like all of this stuff is adding so anybody can come to if it's not just for rich people. And
I do think it makes a difference in your soul. I mean, where I live, we have a couple of libraries, but I go to the pretty one. It makes me happy, right?
Yeah. Go to the pretty one. Yep.
Okay, so this might come to your head when I say in 2012, she built the Aquatic Center for the London Olympics. And so this brought her into very public view.
Okay.
In a way
outside
that I probably
of
wasn't
her industry,
paying attention.
Probably. Yeah.
Outside of her industry, right?
Yeah.
Now this is where, okay, first of all, that one is my child's favorite. So I love it the most
too. I'm sure if I saw it, I'd be like, oh yeah, but I can't bring it to
you
my
would,
mind.
Cause
right
I went,
now.
Oh, her. But I don't think I put a name to it. I just remember, but it was criticized because it's gorgeous. But if you were in the top rows because of the gorgeous layout, you can't necessarily see the pool, you know?
So
sometimes for example, she started getting criticism for this. The National Museum of Arts of the 21st Century, otherwise known as MAXI, this is in Rome. She designed it between 1998 and 2012. That's when it was built. So the building, it's again, a National Museum of Arts. It is a long curved one floor maze. And because it's curved, it's hard to like place any objects on the wall. And because it's so big, if you did put a big painting, it kind of got lost inside of it. And so now that building is just like a big old monument with no art.
Oh.
That said, she won the Sterling Prize, which is the UK's most prestigious award for architecture, first for the Maxi in Rome, and then in 2011 for the Evelyn Grace Academy, which is a school in Brixton, London. So, and there's more controversy. I still think her art is so beautiful.
But I also think, like, isn't that something you do in the planning of, like, okay, here are the designs, and shouldn't there be consultants be like, so where's the artwork going to go before you start building? Like, I feel like those are fundamental questions you need to ask.
Theoretically, yes. But then you think, well, she is the hired designer and the firm that is building it is her firm.
I get that. But that is, everyone needs help. Even people building spaceships. Like, everyone needs help. Everyone needs consultation. Like, as a writer, everyone needs notes. Who you get the notes from is the thing, because you need good notes.
Here's what I will ask you. I have a question. Have you ever seen a TV show or a movie written, produced, directed, and starring one person?
Yeah.
that's what's happening.
That's what's happening. Right? Okay. Okay. Gotcha. Because also now she's so successful. It's like, oh yeah, she'll just do it. But I also think that that is a trap for artists.
It is a trap.
It's a trap that is why you do need, people you trust, whose opinions you trust, because you know, even as like, let's say as a performer, right? You think you're doing one thing. That's one thing you learn in your training, but what you think you're doing is not always what you're doing.
Nope.
The people watching you.
Yuck. Yeah, they know what you're doing.
You're doing what you think you're doing, right?
And I remember once when I was in high school and I was working on a monologue. I was very like emotional and I was like, I have every emotion. I'm 12, you know, and I was my mom was helping with it. And I thought, oh, I was so connected. I'm a genius. And my mom was like, all you did was cry. I couldn't even hear you.
No, I couldn't hear you.
And I was like, what?
But inside, what the kids say, you ate inside. You're like, I ate that. And your mom's like, all you did was cry and mumbled. No.
I don't. Are you okay?
Side note, one of my favorite things that Steve Martin does a lot as a comic, like, have you seen Only Murders in the Building?
Of course I have. Okay,
the first season where, and he's done this in other things, but the first season where he's like, the murderer, I don't want to ruin it for like a 3-year-old show or 2-year-old show. Like, the murderer gave him like something to paralyze him. And his friends come in and they put him in a cart and then they go down to the boiler room and they're confronting the killer. And he gets up in his mind. He gets up like, oh, he gets out of it. He's like, you're not doing this. And then they cut to what's really happening. He's like paralyzed.
Oh, my God. It's brilliant.
It's like, oh, my God. It's like, or like somebody online was talking about some Gen Z was like, this is what Gen X thinks they look like at the club. And it shows like Bobby Brown, like every little step I take, like he's dancing. And it's like, this is what you really look like.
Oh, God. Showing me.
You look like you're having a fit. Working it you're out. Like, what is going on?
Listen, y'all can't see, but I just dance so good. Jealous.
She danced so good. So it's all in your head. So that sounds like what's happening with her work. So
that's, probably. Now,
doesn't mean she's not brilliant and accomplished, but it just like everyone needs like input, you know?
Yeah. And she did also run into trouble because she took, so there's this giant cultural and conference center that she made, the Heydar Aliyev Center in Baku, Azerbaijan?
Azerbaijan, yeah. I think that's how you say it. At least that's how we say it in America. I'm sure
I know.
Might not be the right. Yeah.
So the building itself, amazing. She was awarded Britain's most prestigious prize in architecture. Everyone's saying this is the most prestigious. I don't know. But it's a really prestigious award.
It's fancy stuff. She's winning a bunch of fancy.
Year. Yeah. But the building was named for the former ruler, Heydar Aliyev, commissioned by his son, Ilham, who became president after his father's death in 2003. But Hugh Williamson, who is the director of the Human Rights Watch for Europe and Central Asia, called him, quote, an authoritarian leader, and so is his son.
Oh.
And he's been accused of all kinds of human rights abuses. So it was like, should she win an award for memorializing a vicious Soviet dictator? Like, that
now you have
question.
To start thinking about, I don't need to take every job.
Right.
Like, so do I want to be in business? But I think sometimes artists would be like, well, I just want to complete this project.
I have a theory. Like, I have a vision.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
No.
Exactly.
That's what I think they do. Yeah. And it's not that she agrees with cruelty.
Right.
It's that it's a space. It's, you know, it's time and space. It's area. You know,
which is her right. But there's consequences for working with people who are deemed authoritarian.
Right. I would just take the money you make from it and like donate it to.
Yeah. Like, and, but things. I get it as an artist. I understand. Yeah. You're just like, oh, I want to complete this vision. So.
Yeah, I do. It's like, when I say these things, I think it's complexity.
Yeah.
I think you and I don't know enough. to like.
Yes, because again, Miriam, when I go to space.
Yes.
And let's say I'm trying to get to Jupiter. Right?
Yeah.
And the person is funding the money. They're like, then you have to decide, is it worth going to Jupiter for this? But I always like, well, who are they hurting? Like, are we going to Jupiter and then like a billion people or a million people are going to be killed on Earth? And for me, it wouldn't be worth it. But I'm not in that position. So
you're not going to Jupiter yet.
And a lot of times you're in business with people you don't really necessarily know how terrible they are. And then people educate you. That's why it's always good to have organizations that would be like, oh, actually, no.
And I think this was like, it was written about, I think it was after the fact.
Oh, yeah.
So I think there was a little bit like,
yeah,
what are you going to do? You know, I don't know. I don't know. Tell me I'm wrong. You know,
no,
I love
but it's
to
good
be,
to know me. This because everybody's complex. So,
So this was, do you remember seeing pictures of Qatar Stadium that she made?
No.
Now, okay. The sad thing is that some builders died on construction. So there was a lot of, this was not her fault. This was just how the way they were running construction on it.
Yeah.
But she was in the paper a lot because of it.
Oh.
And then when it was built, now here's what I will say, and I don't have a problem with it. It's shaped like a vagina. It looks like a big old vagina, huge vag.
Well, there's a lot of buildings shaped like penises, so I'm good.
Listen, they took a penis to space. Let's build a vagina.
They took multiple penises to space.
I mean, they did. So it's time for a vagina. Let's make this fair, I'm saying.
I'm all for a vagina building, okay?
Now, she says, no, this is not a vagina. It's a traditional Arabic boat called a dhow.
Okay.
Well, dhows look like vaginas. Okay. So,
pussy power.
Two birds. Pussy power, y'all.
Pussy power, baby. That's right.
So, I mean, you guys, this is the tiny tip of her life. I skipped so many.
You said tiny tip.
Yes, I did.
I'm a 12-year-old boy now.
Yes, you are.
After saying vagina. Okay.
Because that vagina was big.
I'm sorry.
Girl, can't take you anywhere. Okay.
What's wrong with us? Me, it's you too.
I don't know what you're talking about. Did I just say huge vagina over and over again? No. Good thing we're not recording yet, right?
Right. Oh, my God.
Okay, so unfortunately, Zaha died at the age of 65. Yes, very young.
No.
She was being treated for bronchitis in a Miami clinic, and she died of a heart attack.
No.
So, yeah, I know, right? That's crazy. Way too young.
Oh, man. Yeah, you gotta take care of yourself. You gotta get your...
Yeah.
And I'm saying this as someone who's not currently doing that, but you gotta get your massages. You gotta meditate. You gotta eat right. You gotta move your body.
You gotta go to the doctor, get your checkups, get your annual.
Amen to that. Yep.
But her business is sort of continuing on. So her firm partner is Patrick Schumacher, and he continues her work. They worked together for 28 years, and he truly understands like what her visions were, and he's continuing a lot of projects that were still ongoing, it's still happening. And that she was not married. She never had kids. They say she was happily married to her work and wanted to focus on that.
Yeah.
And that is a little bit of Zaha Hadid. Again, this would be a 9-hour podcast. She did so much.
Wow. And her 65 years?
65 years.
Thank you so much for sharing that.
Of course.
Yeah. But I mean, yes, at least she has a legacy that lives on, much like yes. Abigail Adams as well. So
yeah,
that's
right.
the important thing, I think, as a human being, to we all want to have a legacy, whether that's a big one or a small one, but,
right.
you know, exactly. within our society. So thank you so much for sharing that. Guys, thank you for joining us for another episode of Notorious Women Podcast. I didn't say it at the top, but always what? Remember the things and remember to follow us on all the things.
Yes,
including,
please.
Yes, please. Including the Apple Store. Again, if you can also leave us a 5-star review, we'd greatly appreciate that. And also, again, copy the link and share it with your friends and loved ones. If you want them to hear this podcast, copy the link and just send it to them. Don't just say, oh, yeah. Notorious Women, because people forget. They get busy. They got busy lives, trying to figure out how to go to space like me. You know, mm-hmm. they're just busy.
Exhausting.
And so just copy the link and send it to them. Also, if you want to support the show financially, you can do that through patreon.com/notoriouswomen. That's patreon.com/notoriouswomen at patreon.com/notoriouswomen. Miriam, how else can they support the show and find us?
You guys, we are on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Notorious Women Podcast. Please join us there, especially Instagram. It's so much fun, you guys. So many yeah. things to talk about. You can listen to episodes on YouTube if you'd like. And you can email us at notoriouswmpod@gmail.com. If you have bigger things to send us, you can also DM us on Insta. And that is that.
Yeah, and we hope you guys are enjoying your summer and staying cool, keeping a cool head, because we want all of you all to be bad bitches and bad
That's
people.
Right. That's right.
In the good sense, bad meaning good. You know what I mean.
You guys know.
And eat ice cream and take mm-hmm. a dip in the pool, whether it's chlorine or salt water. And
that's right.
We will see you guys next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Produced by Atavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.